My mother was the third of four children. She had two sisters and a brother, and from childhood, my grandmother Thompson seemed to rely on her more than she relied on the others. Her mother once described her as the strongest of her children, which my mother couldn't understand, but maybe Grandmother Thompson was on to something because my mother is 97 and is still living in an independent living thing, and she's outlived all of her siblings. She was driving a car at the age of 12, back when you didn't need a license, and she would take my grandmother around before she went to school. And my grandmother would make sandwiches, and she would sell them to business people to eat for lunch. And my mother was the driver for this, and my grandmother would run in and deliver the sandwiches. And the school principal called my grandmother in and said, "Sarah Forrest is being late to school. She can't be late to school." And mother said all that meant was we didn't sell fewer sandwiches. We just got up earlier so I could get to school on time. They all worked relentlessly to keep this family financially afloat during the Great Depression, but mother seemed to be the go-to girl in the bunch. My uncle said, "There wasn't a comfortable chair in the house, but we didn't need a comfortable chair because nobody ever sat down anyway." One day, my mother took her elderly widowed mother and her Aunt Ivy to the home of her older sister for lunch. On the way home, her mother and Aunt Ivy bragged on what a lovely lunch it was and what a great job Margaret had done. Mother got irritated. What, she asked, was so special about this lunch? It was a lunch for four people. She had done lunches for a lot more than that, and nobody thought it was special. She couldn't figure this out. Her mother simply said to her, "Sarah Forrest, you don't understand." I think Mother would like to have been the favorite child, but instead she was the chosen child, and there's a big difference. Israel was always getting confused about the difference. The disciples of Jesus did too. Being chosen is always linked to a calling, a job, a task of some kind. Abraham was chosen, the story says, because God wanted to bless the world through Abraham and his descendants. Moses was chosen, but he had the good sense to realize that this might not be an altogether pleasant experience, and he objected and said he was the wrong person and he didn't want to go, but God outvoted him and he had to go anyway. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was almost alone and getting praise when she was chosen. "You have found favor with God." But she's given very little choice in the matter if you read the story, and she clearly has no idea what she is getting into. The disciples answer the call of Jesus to follow him. They were chosen, and at the time, in the moment, they may have felt flattered. But from there on out, they got a lot of criticism, and some of them ended up being executed, as was Jesus. Jesus never called them his favorite people. He only called them his chosen disciples, chosen for work that needed doing. St. Teresa of Avila, who lived in the 1500s, reported that she complained to Jesus about all the hostility and gossip turned toward her. And Jesus said, "Teresa, that's how I treat my friends." And she said, "No wonder you have so few of them." We have just spent some time in July celebrating the 4th of July, and there are many Americans who believe that the United States is the chosen nation, chosen by God, a kind of new Israel. I have no idea what the United States of America is in the mind of God. I tend to be suspicious of people who tell me that they know the mind of God. I take seriously that saying, "Your ways are not my ways," and think that I probably haven't got this completely right. But if the United States is in any way chosen, that doesn't mean we're God's favorite country. It means that God wants to bless the world through the United States for purposes that are God's own and may have very little to do with what we want. That is the biblical notion of being chosen. These days, we emphasize the love of God for all God's people, and I believe that. I believe that God is love and that God loves us and that we are supposed to love one another as God has first loved us. All good theology. But what I want and can't get is a God who sends me roses with a little card that says, "Just wanted you to know how much I love you. I'm so glad you're mine. Thanks for all your hard work. Love, God." Good luck with that. That is nowhere in the Bible, nowhere. No, when you hear from God, it is usually with a "got a job for you" card attached. "Got a job for you. Got a job I need you to do. Got a job I need your country to do. Got a job I need your church to do." Simon Peter, James, and John had jobs. They were fishermen. Not glamorous work, but reliable, and they knew how to do it. Then they got chosen. They didn't have a clue about this new job. No job description. There's this crazy notion that when you get called, everything gets clearer. You have a mission. Your life is all taken care of. You have purpose and meaning and even joy. You know what to do. No, you don't. Often you don't gain clarity. There may be a great fog that descends and stays there for years, or you may trade one kind of clarity for another. Things do not get easier, not for churches, not for individuals, not for nations. Mother Teresa got the kind of call we think about when we hear the term call. It happened on a certain day, and she could name it. It was clear and compelling. She was told to go to Calcutta, find those poor people that were dying on the streets of Calcutta, take them in and take care of them. And she did it. But what was left out of the story until after she died was that after a number of mystical experiences of Jesus, they stopped. She felt abandoned. She felt desolate. She entered something that might be called the dark night of the soul, which is what it was called in the Middle Ages. And she endured this for most of her life. The only reason we know it is she wrote it in letters, but she intended for those letters to be destroyed after she died and for no one to ever see them. But that didn't happen. Now, why did this happen to her? I don't know. I do know that it is an important witness to the rest of us who are not living in a perpetual state of joy. I believe some people respond to being chosen without any understanding that they are being chosen. Oskar Schindler was a member of the Nazi Party and saved about 1,200 Jews. Did he think of himself as chosen? I believe some people are chosen. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which we think of as a kind of Protestant Christian martyr, he was executed on the express orders of Hitler right before Hitler's own death, and he didn't save anybody. But he met his calling. He was a theologian. He was an inspiration to people, and he certainly understood the notion of calling. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer, we found out, suffered from depression most of his life. Why? It was only at the very end, when he was in a prison, not a concentration camp, but a prison, and knew that he was probably going to be executed, it was only then that the depression sort of lifted. So when people tell the United States that it is chosen, or when we tell ourselves that story, we might want to remember what chosenness is all about. It is not about getting to be the richest or most powerful nation. It isn't about being the best or God's favorite. It is only about doing something, having a job, usually a very hard one that fits God's purposes, but might not necessarily fit our own. But how do we know if we are called or chosen for something? Sometimes you know and sometimes you don't. And sometimes you only know after you've already done the thing you were called to do. You look back on it and you go, oh, got it. It's a good question to ask ourselves about our own lives, about our church, about our country. What is my role here? What am I called to do? Am I chosen for anything in particular? Just because something needs doing doesn't mean you're the one to do it, or I'm the one to do it. I knew of a school teacher that suffered from periodic mental breakdowns and would have to be hospitalized. She was actually a good Presbyterian woman. She believed in education. She believed in education for the poor. She believed in public schools. And therefore, she concluded that she should be the one to teach in such a school. Finally, she and the school mutually agreed that she could not continue in her role as a teacher. And she never suffered a breakdown again. She probably made the mistake of thinking that because something needed doing and because she knew it needed doing, that she was the one to do it. And maybe that wasn't true. A former student of mine sent me a book about a physician who also felt called to serve the poor. He lived in a building in an urban area, and his office was on the first floor, and his family was housed on the upper floors. And he would never turn anyone away. If somebody rang the doorbell at 3 a.m., he went down and answered the door. He never took days off. He thought he should be on call all the time to meet the needs of people. But like the teacher, periodically he would have some sort of physical breakdown, and he would have to stop. And I met a man one time who had done urban ministry in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I asked him if he knew about this book. Had he read it? And he said, yeah, I read it. I said, well, what did you think? He said, I think the man needed to find some people to help him. He said he wasn't supposed to be doing that all by himself. He couldn't. But the man simply felt guilty if he couldn't be the one doing it all of the time, all by himself. So what do we do? How do we know? First of all, it's normal not to know. It's normal to live without knowing. Trust that when you really need to know, you will. But most of us, most of the time, don't know exactly what we're supposed to be doing. It's all right. It's nothing to feel guilty over or lesser than because you don't know this. If we say to God what we often say to people, just let me know if there's anything I can do, God may let you know. Be prepared. God may just take you at your word, but you may not know until it's over, until you've already done it. And if you do get chosen, take a deep breath and go for it. You need to do it, but check it out with other people. Presbyterians always said, just because you think you're called to do something doesn't mean we think you're called to do something, and you got to check it out with us. The Quakers have a really interesting system. They have something called the Clearness Committee, and if you have a big decision to make, you assemble these people, and you tell them what the situation is, and they sit there, and they simply ask you questions. They can never make a statement. They can never get advice. And every hour, there's someone who's designated to sum up what has been said thus far. And then they'll go at it another hour. There was a man named Parker Palmer, well, he's still alive, and he was asked to be a president of an educational institution, and he had always wanted to be president of an educational institution. But he was Quaker, so he called together all the people, and he told the situation, and they started asking him questions. And he said, I heard myself saying, when they said, what is it that you like about being president of an institution? And he said, I heard myself saying, now, what I don't like is that it doesn't give me any free time to read and do things. And what I don't like is that they said, Parker, but what is it that you like? And he realized that what he liked was the idea of it, the status of it. And at the end, one guy said, Parker, don't you think there's a better way to get your picture in the paper than being president of this institution? And he said, I walked right to the phone when I left and said, I cannot accept this position. We need other people to kind of ask us the right questions. What God has that we don't have is the big picture. And if we get chosen, it's not because we're God's favorites. It's because, like my mother, it's something we can do that needs doing. God can see the big picture with all the moving parts, and God has divine purposes that are so much larger than ours, we can't even see it. And at times we're drawn into those purposes in ways we can't comprehend. God doesn't choose us to make us happy or more fulfilled. Gosh, I wish God did choose me to make me happier and more fulfilled. I like that idea. God chooses us because we are needed for some purpose. If God chooses this country, it is not to make our lives easier, but for some divine purpose so God can bless the world through us. It is hard duty to be chosen, and it may not feel good. It is only in the end that we may glimpse that larger purpose and how much our little piece, and all our pieces are little, our little piece was needed. I think now that my mother's life is almost over, when she thinks about it and thinks about her life and her life with her family growing up and as an adult, I think she is gratified that she was the one her mother depended on so much. I think she's gratified by her chosen role. When hardships come because of what we may be chosen to do, in the end, can we trust that we will be glad?